This is Holidays Unbound, Episode 1, Introductions. Welcome everyone, I'm Dan Liebenson, and I'm here with my co-host,
Ruth Abush-Megder.
And you may remember Ruth from Judaism Unbound's episode looking at Hanukkah a few months ago, and we're super excited to be bringing you this first episode of this basically trial series that we're creating for a few episodes called Holidays Unbound. We hope to launch this as a full separate podcast series in a few months when we can raise the money to hire an editor. So if you're out there and you're someone who loves the potential of this podcast and can help us raise the money to hire an editor, we would be very much in your service. In the meantime, we're excited to get going and to introduce this podcast. We are going to be looking at the Jewish holidays. The idea of the podcast in its ultimate form that we hope is that we're going to be able to create a pretty long series on each Jewish holiday before the holiday starts, maybe something like 10 episodes. And we're going to try to do the podcast journalism style where we have more than one conversation in a particular podcast episode, maybe three subjects or so, like This American Life, that kind of thing, in an episode. And we're hoping to be able to expose our listeners to something like 30 different new ideas relating to every Jewish holiday as a way of giving you enough information, enough ideas, enough creative suggestions so that you can mix it all up and do something new on your own and then report back to us on what you're doing. So, Ruth, are there any other ways you want to introduce the basic concept of the podcast?
The holidays are really fun. They're easily accessible, and each of us can do them in our own way. You can do them with a big community, but you can do them on your own. And it's a great way to play around with some of the Jewish ideas. And we are hoping to give you not only ideas, but also some practical ideas and tips for how to make the holiday yours and your own.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing to point out early on, the way in which this podcast is hopefully going to be different from Judaism Unbound. And actually, we really see this as the first of a number of new podcasts that we hope to launch over the next year or two in the Judaism Unbound enterprise, where we're going to look at all sorts of different aspects of Judaism. And our intent is to go very practical, right? That Judaism Unbound is kind of a meta podcast. It's really trying to build a set of ideas about how we are essentially permitted to play around with this material, how we've done that in the past, how people are doing that in the present, what that might look like in the future. And that's fine. Now you feel like you have permission to do it, but now it's time to actually do it. So is there anything that we can do to help? We've been asked that question. We've started to do that a bit with our website. You can go on the JudaismUnbound.com website under resources and look at some stuff that we've put together about the holidays. We're hoping to expand that radically in partnership with this podcast. We thought that we would start with the holidays. At least I'm going to put out my thoughts on why I think we're starting out with the holidays. Even a lot of people who are not especially affiliated with Jewish institutions nevertheless like to celebrate the holidays. In those studies that show a very large number of Jews not being affiliated with Jewish organizations or not even calling Judaism a religion in the way that it functions in their lives, nevertheless, first of all, a tremendous number of them express pride in being Jewish, and about a half of them or more say that being Jewish is really important to them in their lives. And when you dig deeper at that, one of the things that you find that a lot of those people are doing is that they are celebrating the Jewish holidays in various ways. And I think, at least for me, the question becomes, how can that celebration of the Jewish holidays move from being something that is really valuable, but is really largely about gathering with family and kind of marking the Jewish days in some way that's essentially about our family getting together, a few rituals, but we don't really think all that deeply about them. Is there a way to move to finding content for those holidays that's even deeper, but that resonates with what you're looking to do in your life, as opposed to what somebody else might be suggesting that you do with your life? So our agenda here is not to suggest to people what they should do. Our agenda is to make available all sorts of ideas. That's how I see it, at least. How about you, Ruth?
I don't want us to forget about the element of fun. You know, like, who doesn't love a good holiday? I think that in some ways holidays are popular because they're fun. And I think because we get together with family and friends, and just like the Super Bowl can be fun, and we're glad to dress things up for having a derby day when it's the Kentucky Derby, we can do that with holidays. We can make them fun and we can have them have meaning. So the question is, how do we make them work for us in our lives? And I'm here because I like the holidays. And I think a lot of Jews who drop in and out of Jewish life, that's a lot of us, find the holidays a good place to be engaged. And you don't need a rabbi, and you don't need a lot of dues, or you don't need a lot of materials. You can just do it on your own. But we also know that if you have the materials and if you have the access, you might get more out of it. So we want you to have fun. We want you to have a chance to learn things, and we want it to be meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. As I think about what we're doing and how it sort of dovetails with the big ideas that we're trying to talk about in Judaism Unbound, maybe one way to think about it is sort of top down versus bottom up. It's not to say that Judaism Unbound is trying to push anything from the top down. Top down, I mean, it's sort of starting from the most big picture ideas and then trying to ask, you know, how might those ideas sort of filter down into practice. But I think an equally powerful and exciting way that a new approach to living Jewishly might come about is simply by people just doing stuff in their lives. And yeah, you know, I think that that's an important distinction that we made when I sort of talked about, could we figure out some more meaningful rituals for the holidays in different ways? And then you brought in the idea of, well, could we just have fun? I think we both agree that both are important. But ultimately, I think that what we both have is this excitement about trusting the experience of people who are doing this stuff on the ground. And I guess that I would say that really what I just hope happens is that many, many, many more experiments start getting run on the ground as a result of people listening to what they listen to here. And that based on people just doing all kinds of different things and then telling each other about what they're doing, and then that just sort of bubbling up into other people saying, oh yeah, I want to try that too, that over time, that might cohere into a new set of ideas. And I do want to just also note that holidays is where we're starting in terms of our Judaism Unbound enterprise, but ultimately we want to get into all the different aspects of what a Jewish life might be made out of. And we really just are starting with holidays because we think that's probably where people are already mucking around with it.
And like I said, I just love them.
Yep.
They're fun. And I think that we're just at the beginning of this enterprise. And if we can make this work, we're going to be relying on you, our listener, for your ideas of what works best for you. It can't just be me and Dan and a lot of experts. We're going to need your help to make this work. We're sure that those good ideas are out there. We might not know about them yet, but we're certain that by the end of this project, we're going to know a lot more about what we don't know.
Right. And as we see it developing, I think that we definitely see as part of what we want to have as part of these episodes is going to include interviews with regular Jews who are doing interesting things in terms of the holidays. And actually, I think that as the podcast goes on, I'm really hoping that we'll have almost all interviews with just regular Jews, right? Because of this whole idea that people are going to report back to us on what they're doing, and we're going to be able to share that more widely. We're also hoping to be able to do that on our website. So over the course of time, we want to really expand that holiday section of the Judaism Unbound website, where we're going to have all kinds of information, all kinds of pictures, videos, reports on what people are doing in their regular lives. So we really encourage you, as you listen to this, to send us your ideas, to send us your thoughts, and to send us examples of what you're doing that we can post on our website and share with others, and ultimately that we can talk to you about one day on the podcast.
We're really interested in engaging and talking about it.
And so we're excited to share an interview that we did recently with Abigail Pogrebin. She's a well-known writer, probably most famous in the Jewish community for her book, Stars of David, Prominent Jews Talk About Being Jewish. But she was formerly a broadcast producer for Fred Friendly, Charlie Rose, and Bill Moyers, and then for Ed Bradley and Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes. So she's got a lot of interesting life experience. And as one of them, she's recently jumped into the Jewish holidays. She's taken a year-long journey along the lines of A.J. Jacobs' The Year of Living Biblically, and he actually wrote the introduction to her book. And she really just dove right in and did something that maybe nobody has ever done before, which is really to take a deep dive into all the Jewish holidays from the perspective of someone who didn't do that in their regular life. And so she wrote a book about it, which was published just a couple of weeks ago by Fig Tree Books. The book is called My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. And we're really excited to share our interview with Abigail Pogrebin about what she discovered in the process of researching and writing this book. Abigail, welcome. It's so great to have you. So to start off, we just really wanted to get into the basics of this project. You decided to spend a year celebrating all the Jewish holidays, and I imagine that wasn't your practice before. And we're just wondering how you came to launch this project.
I decided to do what I call extreme sport Judaism, really, first of all, to kind of make up for an ignorance that bothered me. It just kind of irked me. year after year to see that there were so many holidays I didn't understand and not really be able to evaluate whether they might be kind of value added in my life because I just didn't understand them in the first place. So part of this project was to fill in those gaps. The other reason why I embarked on this, I think, was to really test the tradition against today, which is to say, this is obviously an ancient faith, but it has held on, and not by any miracle, but by people deciding it was powerful enough and important enough to preserve it and to continue to observe these things, that many of which were instituted, created, obviously, millennia ago, and to really explore both as a journalist and as a Jew why those traditions have stood the test of time and whether they could, in fact, affect my life in ways that would change it.
So you talk about two fascinating conversations that you had early on in this project, or that kind of got you going on this project. One was with the well-known literary critic Leon Wieseltier, and the other was with Rabbi Irwin Kula, who was actually a recent guest on Judaism Unbound and is the co-president of Klal. Could you tell us a little bit about those conversations?
The conversation with Leon Wieseltier, who obviously is a very erudite writer and thinker, used to be at the New Republic, now at Brookings, and wrote a book called Kaddish, about saying Kaddish for his father. He was very tough on me in the interview when I told him that many Jews whom I speak to say that Judaism just, quote unquote, doesn't do it for them, that they don't feel a lot in synagogue, that the rituals don't speak to them. And he said, tell me that after they have investigated it. Tell me that after they have broken a little bit of a sweat trying to understand it. There are so many Jews who have decided that Judaism kind of doesn't do it for them without really understanding what they're rejecting. He said, once you understand it, if you reject it, I respect that. But first, kind of take a deeper dive. So that I sort of saw that as a personal gauntlet that he was throwing down to me. And one of the lines that he said that really stuck in my mind was, he said, we have no right to overthrow the traditions that have made it all the way to us. And I thought, you know, there's something extremely powerful about that, the idea that there's some obligation here, that we can't just dismiss something that has endured this long. And so it was, in a sense, a charge, a personal charge to me. Abby, are you going to overthrow or let go of these traditions that have survived this long? Are you going to investigate them and see whether, in a sense, not just like prove they're worth doing? You know, I didn't want to have hubris and say, prove that this Jewish tradition is worth my time. But on some level, it was, if I do my work, is it going to give something back to me? And I certainly would say that the answer was yes. But before I get to that, the other person you mentioned is Rabbi Irwin Kula, who obviously, as you know, is a very fiery, inspiring teacher. And he, when I talked to him, said that Judaism, in a way, does have to be tested in the marketplace. What does this holiday do for us? Because otherwise, why do it? And in this society that we live in now, where everything is at our fingertips, where we don't have to watch television on anyone else's schedule or a movie, we can read 15,000 books on one little device. In a sense, tradition and religion is held up to the same standard. Is it worth my time? Is it worth prioritizing? And in that sense, again, it was kind of another challenge to me to look at these holidays and ask that question, what do these holidays do for us?
So before we do a deep dive into everything in the book, I was wondering if you could just sort of put into words some of the key learnings that you feel that you got out of this process.
I mean, it's a great question, and I don't want to be all like Pollyanna about it and say that I came to the most incredibly deep spiritual place and I've embraced Jewish tradition as an observant Jew for the rest of my life, because that's oversimplistic and it's not the case. What I say I learned, though, is the magic, truly the sparkle of Jewish teaching and tradition and text, and that rituals can open something up depending on where you are in your life, that in a sense, Judaism meets you where you are. I did not expect that, that in a sense, even though Jewish observance is redundant, you know, we are celebrating the same holidays and saying the same prayers and doing the same rituals year after year after year, and many people dismiss them because of its redundancy. I would say that actually part of its power and sustenance and frankly spirituality is in the repetition and the fact that you don't know where you're going to land when that holiday comes back up again, when that ritual comes back around. And that to me, in a way, was a revelation. It may not be a eureka to others, but it was to me. And I think that's partly what some people miss, is that even though the holidays are, repeat, that your experience doesn't. And it's a very kind of agile, nimble tradition in the sense that it something opens up no matter where you are. So I really learned that. I would just say it was a really major takeaway that almost to a holiday, there was ultimately the lesson and the instruction that we should not be asking ourselves about how we feel, how this holiday makes us feel, but what this holiday makes us do. And I didn't anticipate that that was going to be such a urgent, insistent theme of what are you doing for someone else? What are you doing to repair the world? It's not always the lesson of the holiday in its sort of mainstream messaging that it's really about what you are doing. What role are you playing to repair the world? And not in some kind of crunchy granola way, but in a really insistent way. You are here because you're supposed to participate, contribute, and repair, even if you can't fix it at the end of the day.
And when you say that, I'm wondering if that's what you experienced as the way that people are living these holidays and are thinking about these holidays, or is it that what you saw was a potentiality in these holidays, an original intent that may or may not actually be the way that people are experiencing them today, even those who observe them fully in a traditional way?
It's a great question. And I would say I can't speak for how the observant are observing them or feeling them, but it certainly is in the teaching. It's certainly in, as you say, the original construction and in many of the rabbinic interpretations of them. You know, when we say the rabbis, I have learned you're talking about usually the Talmudic rabbis, but also I mean the rabbis I was reading in a contemporary context, whether it be sermons, books, essays, or articles, who very much were emphasizing these themes.
Your takeaway and the eloquence with which you sort of describe the pattern and the flow resonate for me, that ebb and flow between the holidays, the connections between them. To me, what you captured really resonates with the way I think about them. But I wonder about most Jews who pop in and out of the holiday cycle. What can you share with us that you've learned that people who are just popping in and popping out might be able to take away? Or are you now also committed to the idea of doing them all in that more holistic way? Or is it the popping in, popping out okay?
It's exactly the question, because most Jews I know are pop in, pop out Jews. And someone could say that there's judgment in that statement, but I was one of them. So I'm speaking about my own people. And we all know from the Pew study that that's the majority of Jews. It's a great term, even though people are probably afraid of it, the pop-in, pop-out Jews. But I think for those of us who, do a little of this, a little of that, it's absolutely not just better than nothing, but additive in a way that can be profound. And I would never want someone to come away from my crazy ride and say that Abby's prescription for meaning is to do it all. I actually don't think that's realistic, and it's certainly not what I'm going to be doing going forward. What I will say, though, is try something you haven't done before. That, I think, I would be evangelical about. It's always such a cliche to say go out of your comfort zone, but it's really apt here. I don't know about you, but for those of us who don't have the vocabulary and the fluidity of Hebrew, of text, of ritual, of liturgy, there are a lot of barriers of feeling like we're going to feel stupid, be out of our depth, look like we don't know the words, and so we don't begin. And something like Simchat Torah, where you end up dancing with the Torah scrolls, takes a lot of suspension of let's say dignity, and it takes just a kind of a lack of self-consciousness that a lot of us don't have, going into a synagogue and dancing kind of in an unfettered, free way with these texts, sometimes people being exuberant and kind of looking like they've lost their minds. But for me, that was one of the most profound and meaningful nights of this whole year. So I do think what I would say is you don't have to do it all, but it's a shame to say my Judaism is finished. It is fixed. I do these four holidays or five or six, and I'm done, and I'm glad and happy, because I think something, it's kind of counter to what the whole tradition is about, which is that it continues to open. As you know, the rabbis say, turn it and turn it because everything is in it. I think you have to keep turning it, or I would wish that people keep turning it, because I do think there's kind of a sparkle and an impact you don't necessarily expect unless you try.
So I'm thinking about these sort of pop-in, pop-out Jews, whatever we're calling them now, and I would certainly put myself in that category, probably a lot of our listeners. And the question is, how do we go about, without going through your whole year-long deep dive, right? How can regular people go in and, on the one hand, try to honor what Leon Wieseltier was talking about, that we should really look carefully at what we've received and have respect for it and believe that we have some responsibility for it, and on the other side, balance against Erwin Kula's notion that it's really important to look deeply to see if this is still working, if this really can survive in the marketplace or in the sense of what our real needs are.
So much of this comes down to, well, how do I actually do it? I would say in a way that the education is easier than the practice. It's actually fairly easy to have access to great teachers because so much content from these great teachers is available, you know, just on Google. And I would hope that people would kind of look at the people I interviewed, just because I would say it's a curation of a certain kind. But I would also say that in terms of your one's neighborhood JCC or synagogue, no matter what the denomination, because I'm actually a believer that people should cross lines, you know, as much as possible, that it's important to have a Jewish home, and I have one when I didn't used to, but that it's also important to see kind of the practices, rituals, and teachings that people are bringing to it from very different perspectives Jewishly. It's just rich, and it's sort of a shame to decide that you're just going to look at one perspective or receive Judaism through one prism. So, you know, going to your local synagogue sounds kind of cheesy, but going online and seeing what they're doing for, you know, I'm looking through the holidays here. So what are they doing on Sukkot? You know, I had never shaken lulav and etrog, and I would be hard-pressed to teach someone because it was so complicated to me. But see what it's like with your kids or by yourself to, you know, take those two objects you've never held before, if you haven't, and shake them in six directions and ask the rabbi why we're doing it. So, you know, it sounds a little Sesame Street maybe, but to me, it is very much in the action of doing these things, of taking that baby step and saying, I don't know what will happen to me, but I'm going to do this. You know, it's like many rabbis teach, obviously, just light the candles Friday night. I'm not saying that you even have to know all the prayers, know the blessings, but light the candles. For me, lighting Shabbat candles or Hanukkah candles, the menorah, by itself has power, but you kind of don't know it till you do it. So that's kind of what I would say, is you got to do a little bit of digging, but it's there to be had. And by the way, if you go to something awful, and I did sometimes go to things that were terrible, where someone was singing really bad folk songs or there was really bad kind of Jewish theater, you know, we have to be honest about that and have a sense of humor about it and say it's not all going to be great, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to go back and try something else.
In terms of that feeling of that urgency, I think that one of the things that was compelling to me about your writing was how the ritual helps instill that sense of urgency about the world itself and heightens your sense of what is out there. A lot of people feel that urgency by looking at the homeless people in the streets. They feel that urgency by looking at various pieces of legislation that they don't agree with. So what do you think that the religious side and the ritual adds to it that you can't get from just walking around in your regular life?
You certainly don't need Judaism to feel an urgency for action, for participation, for contribution, or a sense of what's my role in the world. But I do think there is some kind of undergirding or scaffolding about what we've inherited that kind of gives it a framework. So it's in a way a bit of a roadmap for how to find meaning in one's life and to find one's purpose. And I'm the first person to roll my eyes at those words. What's my purpose? You know, isn't there kind of hubris in thinking we all have a purpose, you know? But there is something that changed for me in the idea that my inheritance demands it. And so I would just say that in some way it's directional, that it kind of gives you, it points to the road that we should be on, however we want to interpret that road to be. And I certainly think that's a universal kind of impulse, is to find one's, how are we going to put our stamp on the world and how are we going to leave our mark? And it's not just about putting our name on something, but about knowing that we made a difference in someone's life in a very personal way or in a larger kind of organizational way or societal way. We don't want to, I hope, just be entirely solipsistic and feel good about our spin class and our bodies. And we've raised these great kids who've gone to great schools and we, you know, have these great relationships and it's all, we're great. There's got to be something that we're also doing for someone else to lift up someone else out of their struggle or suffering. And how do we kind of frame that? I think Judaism gives you a frame and it also kind of gives you a push. Yom Kippur is often a little bit of a punch that clock. I have done my penance. I have fasted if you fast, and it really sucks not to eat. So I kind of feel like I've suffered and I've gone to synagogue for at least a couple hours, if not the whole day. And I punched the clock. I did my part. And it's not that people are not, I don't want to dismiss what people are feeling on Yom Kippur, but I would venture to say that a vast number of our pop-in, pop-out Jews, the Jews who kind of do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, are not necessarily getting kind of the stepping back larger impact or picture of what we are supposed to be getting our heads around on Yom Kippur, on the high holidays. And that is, to me, that you could die in the next year. That's just a fact. It's not maudlin. It's not to terrify you. I wouldn't tell my kids that when they were younger. But that's what this holiday is supposed to focus your head on. You might not get another year. No one can argue with that fact. We're just not sure that we're getting another year. And if you know that, how does that frame how you want to spend this next year? How do you want to use your time? And to some extent, what your priorities are. And when you start to think that way, at least for me, it's literally like, you know, a shot of maror. You know, it focuses the mind. It clears the sinuses. It makes me sit up kind of stiffer in my chair in synagogue, thinking in a much more kind of pointed way about how I want to construct my life, my time. And we sometimes don't step back and say, wait a second, there's a lot more at stake here. That doesn't mean we have to live like we're dying every day, but I do think it's worth actually thinking about that more often than just on Yom Kippur. And this kind of learning definitely affected my daily life, for no question.
That idea about how you're thinking about Yom Kippur puts me in the mind of what I call the Joseph Campbell dimension of these things, right? The idea that these kind of holidays and other observances and mythology and religion all have these deep psychological capacities and this deep psychological power. And I'm wondering if there was anything in what you experienced that kind of gave you insight into how people might still be able to tap into that deep psychological, mythological power if they don't necessarily accept all the theological predicates that were the original predicates around which these holidays were built.
Yeah, I think we have to be really honest about how, for many people, God is an obstacle, prayer is an obstacle, the, again, kind of trappings, and I don't say that negatively, the constructs, the requirements. Judaism is extremely demanding in its infrastructure and recipe, but it's also faith. People don't have faith. But I didn't feel like faith was required for this year, either to explore these traditions, these holidays, or to derive great meaning from them. So I think your question is exactly right. It's not what I was testing particularly, whether one needs faith for these things to come alive. But I think one of the virtues of Judaism, that faith is not a requirement to make it come to life or to make it actually add sparkle and joy and depth to your life. And I say that because if you are someone who celebrates Hanukkah, there are so many dimensions to that holiday that can, I think, enrich your thinking, your life with your kids, or your experience of the holiday season without necessarily believing in God. And what a missed kind of opportunity to enjoy all of those gifts if you are saying, well, I'm not going to do them because I actually am not a believer. I think that all of these iterations are worth exploring for people who, before they dismiss the whole of it, you know, like at least look at what's out there because so much is, and then tell me that none of it speaks to you.
So as you look back on this experience and reflect forward on what you think you might do in the future, and thinking about people who aren't going to jump in and observe all the holidays, do you think that the greatest power would be to sort of do the same holiday every year and experience it differently every year and more powerfully and maybe build upon it year by year? Or do you think that the power is really in the connectivity between the holidays so that it would actually be better to observe all of them a little than just a few of them a lot?
I mean, you kind of just gave me an idea, which is, I think, even for me, I'm still daunted by that question of, do I have to do it all to kind of be authentic to this journey I took? And in a way, it makes me think I should just choose a few and stick with them that I've added to my life. It's actually, I mean, I say this genuinely, I think that's kind of a really good approach that I haven't thought of. For me, it has been a little harder to kind of figure out what I want to stick with. And so sometimes I've abandoned more than I've held on to in just the 2 years since I did this. But what I would say is, to your point about how they all connect, that was a revelation to me. And I would say many Jews have the same kind of lack of appreciation of how logical and intentional these holidays are that come one after another, particularly in the fall when you get one every 5 seconds. And it was, you know, truly a challenge to keep up. I used to think that they were kind of random, that Sukkot was a complete non sequitur to Yom Kippur. Why are we suddenly building this like quaint hut with these wreaths and garlands of fruit and gourds and all these things after we've been in synagogue all day? I thought that was just kind of thrown in there. Now I understand how connected those two holidays are. And even something like front-loading the holidays to the summer. I thought everything started on Rosh Hashanah. Now I understand it starts in the summer. Atonement is supposed to start 30 days before we get to Atonement, the big day of Atonement, the mother load of Atonement on Yom Kippur. All of those things, understanding that this is a marathon, not a sprint, that these are interwoven in a way that is kind of, I think, brilliant, to me completely changed the year. And that is lasting. Whatever I actually celebrate or choose not to celebrate, that is something that will stick with me forever. And it gives it meaning by itself, because I think a lot of Jews feel like, oh, this is so random, disconnected, and arbitrary. Why do any of it? And when you kind of see that it's not, that there was a thinking here, a design. Judaism is by design, and the design in itself to me brings it alive.
Do you have a favorite Jewish holiday?
I mean, it's still Passover, which is a little bit disappointing because that's obviously one of the most popular. Passover is one of the holidays where I thought I kind of knew everything. I think a lot of people kind of think, well, Passover I've got. Hanukkah, I got that one. And both of those were ones that kind of revealed themselves to me in new ways. In terms of one that I had never done before that I thought was kind of remarkable, I would say it was Shavuot, which is the receiving of the Torah on Sinai, and the fact that people stay up all night learning together, something that I don't do easily because I really like my bedtime. There was something quite extraordinary about thousands of Jews coming together at the JCC in New York with this program of kind of bottomless opportunities to learn, staying up into the wee hours together, eating cheesecake, which I didn't realize is what apparently the dairy foods are the safe place to be when you get the Torah because you don't know what the kosher rules are yet. So eating Zabar's cheesecake, with essentially strangers through the night and learning together was, you know, something I think everyone should experience.
You've given us a whole bunch to work with and to think about. And is there anything that we didn't ask you that we could have?
If I'm honest about it, I think that there is something a little nerdy about what I did in terms of my Jewish year, in the sense that I kind of got excited about discovering all the aspects and layers of these holidays, because it felt almost like we are all detectives who have inherited this kind of treasure chest, but it's up to us to unpack it, and you don't know what will kind of gleam and what will be faded and remain so, you know, never kind of come to life for us. And so even though I feel a little kind of defensively, like I can't tell everyone they're going to have that same experience if they, you know, open that treasure chest. But I do want to say that it is part of what I really hope people take away is that there can be a surprise in there. And you don't necessarily need to know what's going to grab you or leave you cold to begin, to open it in the first place.
So that was our interview with Abigail Pogrebin. As a reminder, her new book published by Fig Tree Books is called My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. And it's available now from all fine booksellers. You can go to our website and see it in the show notes and click right over to it on Amazon. And we're really excited about this book. It's a great way to launch our series on the Jewish holidays. Ruth, what were your thoughts after listening to our interview again with Abigail?
What was so exciting to me is that she captures so much of the big picture of why Jewish holidays. And I think we started off by talking about why we've chosen them. And I think that she has a different approach altogether. And when she talks about it, I really feel her excitement and her understanding in a big picture way that frames why we should be bothering with Jewish holidays and why you might want to start with the Jewish holidays, whether they're fun or not, because she takes a look at the pieces, both the fun and the not fun, and gives us a sense of why this might help you live a more meaningful and better life if you start getting engaged in these. And she's really clear that you don't have to be an all or nothing person. You don't have to do everything the way she did, but there's a lot to be gained from this. And that was really exciting to me about talking with her.
Yeah, what I really love about the project itself, her book and a lot of these analogous projects, is that it's really just a regular person, more or less. I mean, she's not a regular person. She is a regular person who used to be a producer on 60 Minutes and has written some other great books, but she's not a Jewish leader certified in some kind of school type of way. She's a regular person who, in terms of the way she thinks about Judaism, I think she thinks about it in a similar way to many, many other regular Jews.
She makes so many good points about how we can really get into the holidays and why this set of practices can be meaningful and helpful. One of the things that I think that still makes me wonder and is an issue for me is, how much do you need to know to get something out of this? And I think that that's a question that I really wonder and I struggle with. As somebody who's got a lot of Jewish education, I see the meaning and the value. But is the need to get all that knowledge and understanding, but if you don't have that, can you still jump in and get something out of it? And I think that that's something I'm still struggling with.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about this kind of question is really using kind of two frames that I think we've talked about somewhat on the Judaism Unbound podcast. One is thinking about the acquisition of knowledge about the holidays, let's say, or any other topic. I think that we should look at it, at least at a starting point, we should look at it as limited in its impact, meaning we should think about, well, this is what these holidays have been in the past. And just because they have been that way in the past doesn't mean that they have to be that way in the future. Once we recognize that these holidays have changed a lot over time, they have changed in terms of refining things and adding things, but they've also changed in terms of taking things away or de-emphasizing things. They've changed in all sorts of different ways. And once we recognize that 2,000 years ago, when they would have learned, here's what Passover is, it turns out that that way Passover was for them in their past is nothing like Passover is today in our present. So if that's the case, then the question becomes, what am I trying to learn when I go back and I learn what this holiday has been in the past, or what does it look like in various contexts or in the traditional context in terms of looking at what we've inherited at our own time? You know, what is the importance of that? And, you know, I'd at least want to put it out there as that it gives you two things. I think it gives you the gives you a lot of raw material that you can remix. And it also gives you the possibility of understanding something really deep that whoever architected that holiday, whether it was a person or just time, but that somehow what stood the test of time was because it accomplished a certain thing in people's lives or a certain set of things. And so we shouldn't just reject it out of hand. We should first try to understand what it was trying to accomplish and ask ourselves whether it's still able to accomplish that now in the current configuration. And I would at least put out there as a possibility that getting at the true purpose of a given holiday may be more successfully done by changing some of its practices or changing some of its concepts or its rituals or whatever it might be, and by actually just playing it out the exactly traditional way may lose the actual purpose of the holiday.
Usually we get a little stuck in our boxes and say, well, this is the way we've always done it. And the way we've always done it might be just the way you always did it at your house growing up. So it's maybe the always has only been the last 50 years. But maybe the way we've always done it is 100 years old. It's hard to know. By listening and talking to different people, I myself, in the process of making this podcast, in the process of talking to Abigail, got a sense of different ways of thinking about things I thought I knew, but I didn't know. And so there's a lot of different ways to think about it, and maybe that'll get you going on a new direction.
Yeah, and the other concept that we've developed in Judaism Unbound that I think is relevant here is this idea of the chutzpah versus knowledge curve. Basically, for our purposes, the point that I want to make here is that in order to reinvent and infuse new meaning, new possibilities into this stuff, you have to kind of have chutzpah. You have to have a little bit of audacity, a little bit of boldness, of daring to say, hey, my voice matters in this, you know, 2,000-3,000-year-old tradition, right? I mean, I have the right to make some tweaks to it and some maybe bigger than tweaks. That does require some chutzpah. And we need more of that chutzpah, because if we don't have it, my hypothesis is that for many people, this stuff isn't going to last, because it needs to be done differently in certain ways and in certain ways not. But if we don't have the willingness to do some things differently, a lot of people are going to say it's not for me. And the question is, where does knowledge fit into that? And I think that there's an extent to which knowledge is helpful in having that chutzpah, right? Because if I have knowledge that this has changed many times before, then that actually helps me have more chutzpah that I can say, well, then why can't it change again? So there's certain knowledge that's really helpful to chutzpah. There's also more knowledge that's helpful to chutzpah, which says, like, yeah, now I've really deep dived into this raw material and I have a lot of ideas, so I'm going to start playing with these. But there's also a possibility that sometimes there's too much knowledge. And I think too much knowledge comes in two possible places, at least in my mind. One is that you learn so much and you realize it's so overwhelming. There's just so much here. I mean, there's literally thousands of years of accumulated stuff here. How can I even wrap my mind around it enough to do anything that I feel is halfway authentic? That's a fear that I think a lot of people have the more knowledge they get. And then there's also a kind of knowledge that says, you know, this is something that we have to preserve. It's lasted for 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. And, you know, what if you make this tweak and the whole thing falls apart, right? This fear that's, you know, how can I do this responsibly? And I think a lot of people get hung up on that. So I think that there's this middle ground that hopefully we can somehow find that says, we don't want to be a know-nothing movement. You should know a lot. There's a lot of knowledge. Knowledge can be helpful in all this. And at the same time, knowledge shouldn't paralyze us. And that's really what I'm excited about exploring on this podcast and beyond.
Sometimes I think we the all-or-nothing approach really doesn't serve our tradition well. Because a lot of times when we say to people, you got to do it all, they choose to do nothing. And I think that there's a lot of space to do some pieces, and figuring out what pieces are going to be meaningful and relevant and what pieces are interesting helps you choose which ones to do. If it's really not going to work for you, and this is kind of a, you know, there's a movement in Judaism called Reconstructionists. They're big on this idea, but I think they're onto something. If it doesn't work for you, then probably that's not the thing that you should keep trying to do. But on the other hand, one of the things I liked about Abigail's approach was you don't know a priori what's going to work unless you try, right? So sometimes the funny thing is you try something and you don't know that you're going to like it or you're not. And so I want to encourage people to try things, both in terms of innovation, but also in terms of tradition, because I think both pieces can help us figure out where we want to go and give us a more refined palette in terms of our understanding of what kind of Judaism works for us. And I think when you play around with it and think about it as something like playing, not feeling so fixed or, oh my goodness, my grandmother would never have approved of this. She might not have, but she wouldn't have approved of you not doing it at all either. So, you know, go ahead, try it. Doesn't work. Let's move on. Something else might.
Well, with that spirit, I'm excited to be moving into the rest of the podcast. Just to give a little bit of a roadmap, the goal is that essentially each episode, and here I'm talking about when this podcast grows up and becomes a full-on weekly podcast, what we are expecting to do is to have a basic theme for each episode and then to explore three parts of that theme as the three different segments of that podcast. Those themes, those parts will include interviews, discussion between me and Ruth, and other kinds of modalities. And depending on how much we're able to edit and what kind of experience of an editor we find, they'll be more or less intricate. So we're really excited to see what happens and what comes about. We are really excited about the topics that we have already gotten interviews for. So we think that this segment on Passover is going to be a really good teaser for what we have in mind to do for every holiday. So
wait, so Dan, so you're basically saying that the way we're doing this podcast with a little experimenting, a little trying, seeing what we can do is pretty much what we're saying you guys should go out and do with your holidays.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. Totally unintentionally. And you know, the fact that we find ourselves in this position because we realized that we had certain constraints is exactly what the issues are in people's lives. And those constraints may be how much time do I really have to think about this, how, you know, et cetera. And I think that what we're saying is we think we can do something really great with the constraints that we have. And if it works, we really hope that those constraints will go away and we'll be able to double down on it and really build something really great. So we're excited about what we have coming up. We are looking forward to a conversation about what's Passover all about. We're going to be looking at the question of the Exodus. We're going to be looking about the Seder. We're going to be looking at the food for Passover. So we've got all kinds of really cool ideas coming up, and we hope that you'll stay tuned. So Ruth, thanks so much for joining me in this episode.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, Dan.
See you, everybody. And this has been Holidays Unbound.